Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The political news cycle is moving so fast, average people can barely keep up. And now the presidential campaign has shifted into high gear with new candidates on the Democratic ticket and that party's convention just around the corner. And of course, all 435 seats in the House are up for grabs in this cycle. And in some states, so are members of the United States Senate. We're going to talk about all of that later with several congressional journalists who report from Capitol Hill. But first, we're going to spend some time with one of our local congresspeople. Congress is on break. Members are visiting with constituents across the country. It's a good time to catch up on things with Democratic 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams. The shape of the 12th District has changed a bit since 2022, but it includes much of Charlotte, and she joins us to talk about this last congressional session, the race ahead, recent changes at the top of the Democratic presidential ticket, and more. Alma Adams, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you again.
You are, in spite of being good to be here, you are one member of one of the most dysfunctional Congresses in recent memory, with a silver-thin majority of Republicans in control. How frustrating has that been for you and for fellow Democrats, and for that matter, all members of Congress?
Well, you're certainly right. It has been the most dysfunctional, and in terms of whether or not this Congress has been able to govern, I'm not sure about that. I don't think we've been able to govern as we should. But I will tell you that in terms of my side of the aisle, we've tried to do our best to put our votes in to make things happen, like keeping the government open four times already. And we've got to make sure that not only have a budget, but that we fund government. So that's one of the things that we still must do. But yeah, so it's been a little frustrating, but in spite of that, we've still tried to get things done for the people that we represent.
You've been in office since 2014 when you won a special election to fill former Congressman Mel Watt's seat. And before that, you served 10 years in the General Assembly. What continues to motivate you to want to run and serve in Congress?
Well, first of all, it was 10 terms, so that's 20 years in the State House, and I taught for 40 while I was doing all of that. But I think, service has been very important to me, making sure that I'm able to deliver. People have various needs, and I think when you understand what they are, you work hard to try to deliver for them. That's been really important to me throughout my political career. From school board to Congress, I've always worked on trying to make sure that whatever the citizens that I represented needed, that at least I worked on trying to get those things resolved for them. Oftentimes you're not able to get everything done, but I think people tend to appreciate the fact that you try on their behalf. And that's what certainly has been my motivation for continuing this work.
For at least some of your time in Washington, the Democrats were in the majority. Now, of course, you're not. What's it like to be a minority member in a Congress where compromise is difficult, if not impossible?
Well, let me just say it is difficult. Sometimes it is impossible. And you're right. I've served when Democrats have been in control. And it's not good being in the minority. I'll just say that. I was the chair on the workforce protections. I still sit on education, but I think a lot of the things that you believe as a member need to happen in terms of legislation, you simply can't get there because there's such a division in terms of how we feel about certain things. So that's been a little difficult to navigate, but nevertheless, because I've been there a while, I've gotten to know, and I've been on the same committees pretty much, And that means I've gotten to know the members and who I can work with and who it's more difficult to work with, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But, you know, still keeping folks to keeping your focus and trying to make sure that you get as much done as you can. And that's basically been what I've tried to do.
If you listen to people on television news and other places, radio news as well, you get the impression that at least for some of the members of the other party, that they are there simply to put up roadblocks to President Biden's agenda or simply to make a name for themselves. Do you think that Republicans, for the most part, are there to be disruptive? Are there simply to block Joe Biden? Are there to become well-known on their own? Or are they there to accomplish their own agenda, which doesn't happen to be yours?
Well, I think all those things are true. but I have found some Republicans that I can work with. As a matter of fact, you know, I have a couple of bipartisan caucuses, and we do have members, not only bipartisan, but bicameral. But yes, I think people come with their own motives in mind. And then when you get into situations where we are now, we're close to elections, people do a lot of grandstanding and simply trying to really get before the cameras. I notice that people act very differently in committee when the cameras are rolling. So yeah, I think a lot of what you've said is true. It's kind of multifaceted. People have different reasons for serving. And I think the primary reason for us serving ought to be to make a difference for the people in our districts. And I'm not sure, you know, I want to make just a difference for myself, but because it's really the people that I represent. All 700,000 in Mecklenburg County, whether they vote for me or not.
But despite some resistance, some pretty stiff resistance on the part of the other party, the Biden administration has been touting what many believe is a considerably successful legislative record of accomplishments. He's been compared, or this presidency has been compared, to that of LBJ and FDR. I don't know that that's an apt comparison. Maybe you can fill me in on that. But what do you see as the most significant accomplishments and of that administration and of Democrats in Congress? And why do you think that message has had a hard time getting out?
Well, you know, I think we have to do a better job of selling that message. I think sometimes you spend so much time trying to get the deliverables that you spend less time. You just think that people automatically ought to know, but they don't. You know, in terms of the Inflation Reduction Act, trying to make sure that healthcare, that we can negotiate those costs now. For our citizens, looking at what we've done with the CHIPS Act, with the Infrastructure Act. So yeah, we've had some successes, and I think they've had a tremendous impact on our citizens, not just here in Mecklenburg County, but throughout our state. So, but we have to do a better job. I'm talking about Democrats now. We're the ones who I believe made the greatest difference. We're the ones who had to pull the Republicans over to make sure the government stayed open four times. And so those are the kinds of things I don't think citizens pay too much attention to. But again, we just have to do a better job of making sure that we deliver the information. It's all about education.
What would that, doing a better job, what would that mean? Who would do it? Will that happen perhaps during this presidential campaign as the candidates stump the country and talk about those accomplishments?
Well, clearly it's going to happen then, but, you know, it's something that, you know, I've tried to do all along through newsletters, having talks with individual citizens, not only in my office, but also doing my annual public meetings with citizens. So I think each member has to take on that responsibility. But the party itself have made a number of attempts to do that. But yes, I think you're going to see more of that as we move into getting to Chicago for the convention that's coming up in a couple of weeks.
You have been a member of the Committee on Education and the Workforce from the very beginning of your time in Congress, and you also founded the HBCU Caucus when you first got there. Of course, HBCUs are historically Black colleges and universities. You're a graduate of one, North Carolina A&T, the largest HBCU in the country. And Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris is also an HBCU grad from Howard University in Washington. What is your caucus, the HBCU caucus, do? What does it do?
Well, basically, we have three goals. As you said, I am a graduate of North Carolina A&T. I'm a proud graduate twice of North Carolina A&T. I spent 40 years on the campus of Bennett College teaching. So HBCU runs through my veins. I am HBCU strong. One of the things that I know as I've served on the campuses, as I've interacted with the HBCUs across this country, more than 100 of them, by the way, I have found that we have serious problems on our campus in terms of infrastructure, those kinds of things. And so, but also discovered that not everyone in Congress really knew anything about HBCUs, the value, the economic contributions that we make, and historically, the contributions our students, our graduates make. So I founded the bipartisan HBCU Caucus. It is not only it's bicameral as well. Representative French Hill from Arkansas, Republican gentleman. We have a good relationship, working relationship. He has HBCUs in his district. Three things we wanted to do. First of all, to expand the knowledge base nationally about HBCUs. Secondly, to educate the Congress about HBCUs. There were some folks in Congress who looked like me who didn't know what HBCUs were. And then finally, to prepare and work on legislation, bipartisan legislation, that would help support our schools and move them into the next century. So we've done a number of things in terms of getting support for our schools. We have the STEAM Day that we do, bringing corporate folks on the Hill as well, and so we have a time when we have the foundation for the Black for the African American Caucus there. I'll say the CBCF. We'll have an opportunity to engage our faculty, our staff, and also members of the community as well. So we have expanded the information. I think people are more knowledgeable. And of course, once people are educated, then they are more receptive to really helping support. And I will just mention, by the way, the Future Act, which I did, I introduced that, and of course, a lot of folks on the other side of the aisle, I hear the candidates running for office on the Republican side are trying to take credit for it. But that bill provides support for all of our HBCUs and MSIs, and we're real proud that we were able to get that bill passed with a considerable amount of support, not only in the House, but also in the Senate.
The presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, is an HBCU grad. And I'm wondering, I have 10 seconds here, what message that is sending? Why is that a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal. First of all, we're going to have an HBCU alum at the top of the ticket. It's going to, I think, encourage other folks and women in particular, little girls in particular, to see that they can be whatever they want to be as they look at Kamala Harris, who's doing a terrific job.
Let me stop you there because we have to go to a break. Congresswoman Alma Adams with us. We're coming right back on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins, where our guest today for this part of the program is the 12th District North Carolina Congresswoman Alma Adams. We're having a little Zoom issue here, a little live stream issue, but that's okay. We're going to continue on here. One of the key issues that Democrats have been highlighting in this presidential campaign, Congresswoman, has been abortion and a right to a woman's access to reproductive health, which has been restricted as the result of the Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court. You say that you have been very distressed at what you're seeing as a result of that decision. What are you seeing?
Well, I certainly believe that a decision about women's health ought to be a decision that they make with their families, their doctors. It should not be an intrusion on the part of the federal government or even local government, state government for that matter. People are very concerned about what the court did and overturning Roe v. Wade. We believe that, first of all, I think it was the wrong thing for them to do. And people are really concerned about it, and it's causing, I think it's going to have a tremendous impact in terms of this upcoming election. But under no circumstances, the government play a role in a woman's reproductive health.
And the Harris campaign
has promised to bring legislation to Congress that would enshrine the provisions of Roe v. Wade into law. Of course, they would need to have control of both houses of Congress and in order to make that happen. So what do you see as the chances of that?
Well, I mean, I feel pretty good about the outcome of this election. I believe we're going to make sure that we keep control of the House and that we increase the numbers that we have, and even control the Senate. So you're right, if we're able to have both chambers, then it'll be a lot easier for President Harris to move it along. And so we're looking forward to getting that back, codifying Roe, because it's not just Democrats who want it and who need it, it's women, regardless of what your affiliation, and it impacts families as well. And so that is going to be something that we're going to work on. I think it's going to be worked on coming right out of the gate.
What happens, do you think, if Donald Trump wins this election in terms of women's reproductive rights? What do you see as the real danger there?
Well, I think that they're looking at a national ban across the country, and of course they're not admitting to that, but there's so many indications that that would be the case. I think just having him as president, period, would be a disaster. I think a lot of people feel that way. We don't need a ruler. We need someone who's going to be concerned about all of the people all of the time, and treat people, all people, with respect, including women. And so I just don't want to think about that. We're going to work hard to make sure that doesn't happen. That's the first thing.
Your congressional district was redrawn between 2022 and this time around. It no longer contains Concord. Other districts were redrawn by the legislature. One popular congressman, North Carolina's Jeff Jackson, was kind of essentially gerrymandered out of a district. And these changes in the maps will likely result in Republicans having greater representation than they probably should have in North Carolina. It's a 7-7 split now between Democrats and Republicans. That will no longer be the case. How do you think these changes will impact citizens here?
Well, you know, I'm going to represent everybody who's in the 12th district. And of course, the new 12th district will basically consist of just inside Charlotte. I will lose all of those county areas. And I do think it's going to impact in terms of the kinds of things that we can get done here. But again, it's going to still depend on what the makeup of the overall Congress is going to be. I've had six different configurations since I have been in Congress for these 10 years. And that has a lot to do with who's in the General Assembly. So what I try to encourage people to do is to think about who you're sending to Raleigh, because that's going to impact who in fact will represent you in Congress. You're right. We're going from 7-7. So we have 14 districts in North Carolina. We're going from seven to now perhaps three, maybe four, 11 or 3, 10. And so that's unfortunate. That's unfair. It certainly has a negative impact on who we are. It does not reflect what the state of North Carolina looks like and should look like. And this is why the court came in the last time and created an even split. And we've done well. I, of course, I am the on the Democrat side. I'm the dean. I've been there the longest. I probably am the oldest too, I guess. But the bottom line is our state is just about evenly divided when you look at the numbers, almost 50-50. So we should have a Congress that also reflects that. And again, that's going to be determined by who represents us in Raleigh. So I keep telling people all politics are local, and we've got to make sure that we pay attention to that. Yes, we've got a very exciting presidential election coming up, but we also need to make provisions for what happens at the local and state government. So we'll be working on that, and we need to do the best for our citizens.
I lose you in about 90 seconds, and you just mentioned the presidential race. I know that you were very excited and very supportive of President Biden's re-election campaign when he decided not to run for re-election. Kamala Harris stepped up. She has been embraced like nothing I've ever seen by a political party. Instantly, she was embraced, and it was as though the Democrats have decided we're going to march in lockstep. How do you feel about her candidacy and her prospects for winning?
I am excited about it. I believe we can win this. As you've seen, all of the excitement and the energizing around her. Yes, the Democrats, we are in lockstep. We're together and we're going to stay together. We're unified and we're going to make a difference. And, I think Kamala Harris is going to be a fantastic president. Clearly, she has won the votes that she needs to, of course, get that nomination. But I believe that we have the right message for the people at the right time. Such a time as this, Kamala Harris is going to be the next president. My soror, my sister, my HBCU sister as well. So we're just excited, real proud about what she's doing and what our party is going to do to get behind her to make this happen.
I know I have to let you go, but you represent a fundamentally Democratic district in Charlotte. When you talk to your cohorts in Congress who perhaps do not represent Democratic districts, but they happen to be Democrats in Congress, what are they hearing from their constituents about this change at the top of the ticket and what this does to the dynamics of this race?
Well, I can tell you they are excited about it, too. We can talk about divisions in party, but it's really about the issues that people are concerned about. And that's going to cross party lines. And it's doing that in many of the districts. I have a number of CBC members, for example, who don't represent all Democrat districts or all districts that are maybe a majority African American, et cetera. So people again are feeling what they need for their day-to-day, their families, and Kamala Harris brings that message. And so I think we're gonna see a lot of people crossing over, helping to make this happen.
North Carolina's Democratic 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams, thank you for being with us. I appreciate your time this morning.
And thank you so very much. And listen, continue your good work.
Thank you. 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams will be running against Republican Abdul Ali in the interest of equal time. He will join us on this program on August 29th, unless something changes. And if it does, we'll let you know. Donald Trump has chosen his running mate. The entire Democratic ticket, of course, was upended when President Biden decided not to run for re-election. And despite predictions of disarray in the Democratic Party, Democrats quickly embraced Vice President Kamala Harris as their nominee. And now she has chosen Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate. As the presidential campaign swings into high gear and ahead of the Democratic convention in just 2 weeks, Congress is on break. Members are campaigning in an election cycle that both parties characterize as existential, and the success of the next president or keeping that president in check will largely depend on the makeup of this new Congress. With that as backdrop, let's talk about all this with two journalists whose beat is Capitol Hill. Daniel Battaglia is congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Reuben Jones is with us. He's the Washington reporter for Spectrum News, covering North Carolina and national politics. Welcome back to you both. Good morning.
Morning.
So, Daniel, let me start with you. Just a couple of weeks ago, Democrats were looking at the upcoming presidential election with deep worry. They were staring into the abyss. Trump was ahead of Biden in the polls. The president had a disastrous debate. After a few weeks, though, he decided not to run. And it's been rumored that he was forced to make that decision by members of Congress, leaders in Congress like Nancy Pelosi and maybe Chuck Schumer on the Senate side and others, along with some well-heeled Democratic Party donors. Pelosi and others have denied putting any pressure on the president. What are you hearing on the Hill?
Well, Spectrum just had a great interview with Pelosi where Cassie had spoken to her and she denied it and said that's giving her way too much credit for her power. But there is that rumor that has been circulating for as long as I think he's been out of office that she did go forward and try to get him to step down, as we heard many leaders did. There was a lot of pressure since the debate for him to leave his campaign, and that kept getting louder and louder as hit the time for him to walk away came.
When President Biden made his announcement, Reuben, there were predictions of a complete disarray that would happen among members of the Democratic Party. That did not happen, even though there were some jostling for position behind the scenes, I'm sure. But Kamala Harris captured the party in a matter of hours, literally hours. And although it took her some time to pick Tim Walz as her running mate, she's done it, and he has been embraced, this governor of Minnesota. They both appear to have infused this race with enthusiasm. Some pundits are referring to it as joy. Is that all for the cameras, or is that the reaction behind the scenes in Washington as well?
I think everybody's a little bit caught off guard. I don't think many people expected just the amount of enthusiasm that we're seeing in these crowds. Mike, I was down in Atlanta last week at Kamala Harris's first organized rally since Biden endorsed her. I mean, a crowd of about 10,000 people down the street waited through a thunderstorm to get inside. And the feeling, and I've heard comparisons of sort of 2008 Barack Obama, and I think there are some similar feelings there. Look, you go into one of these rallies and it does have the feel of more of a musical concert than a political rally. I think the Harris campaign is going for that. We saw yesterday or 2 days ago, they were giving out bracelets that lit up red, white, and blue, similar to what you'd see at a concert. You see a DJ pumping out music, getting the crowd enthused. Music helps, gets young people involved and other folks who aren't involved in political rallies, but the enthusiasm seems to be there anyways, with or without the music.
I don't know if either of you have covered Trump rallies in the past or covered Trump rallies in the last election cycle, but how do the Harris-Walz rallies now compare to what Trump rally goers experienced 4 years ago?
I mean, I think it's similar in the sense of the crowd size. Look, this is something Donald Trump talks so much about, is crowd size. He sort of obsesses about that. And it is very fair to say that he has seen the enthusiasm with his rallies the past few years compared to Democrats. Now we're seeing it with Kamala Harris with very comparable crowd sizes, sometimes even more for Harris. They have a definitely different feel. Danielle could talk about this. They have a definitely different feel in terms of maybe the type of music, the type of people that you're seeing. But the enthusiasm is on both sides when you see the crowd size. The question is whether crowd size equals voters in November.
You know, she had a lot, Kamala Harris, Danielle, had a lot of really good choices in terms of choosing a running mate. A lot of governors among them, Roy Cooper, who declined to be vetted for the position. And there's been a lot of speculation as to why. He hasn't said exactly why he declined, but he seemed to be a front runner for the job. Was it because, what are you hearing? Was it because he was afraid of what Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson might do when he left the state to campaign? Because when the governor leaves in North Carolina, the lieutenant governor can take over and do things. Or was it because he's planning to run against Tom Tillis in two years for the Senate?
I think there's a lot of different elements going into this. Everything I'm hearing is he has not made a firm decision on what he's going to do next, including the U.S. Senate race. He could go U.S. Senate. There's been cabinet positions that make sense for him to take if certain people leave their roles and if Vice President Harris becomes president and wants to put him in those roles. President Biden had made it very clear he wanted to take Cooper into a cabinet position, but, you know, he's not president, or he's not going to be president now. And so, you know, that's up in the air with what Harris wants to do if she becomes president. And then there's also rumors that he could run for governor again in 2028 if Robinson is to win. Everything I heard about Robinson was there was an element of concern that it's one thing for him to leave the state right now as governor and Robinson to make a decision on behalf of the state as the acting governor, which our state law allows him to do. But if he's on a campaign trail as the vice president nominee, it would just turn her campaign into chaos that they didn't need. And he felt like it wasn't the right time for him to be there dealing with that.
And he was rumored to be in line possibly for a cabinet position in the Biden administration. Might he be in line for one in the Harris administration, should that come to pass? Danielle.
I think it's very possible. He has a relationship with Harris. They've known each other since they were both attorneys general of their states. They've had relationships. He's got relationships with President Biden's former son, Beau Biden, as well. And so, you know, the relationship on both sides of that runs pretty deep for Roy Cooper. And I think that there is that possibility.
Ruben, you may need more time to answer this question than we have. We may have to come back at the end of the break and get a second part to your answer, because it seems that the Democrats have circled the wagons here. They have circled around Kamala Harris and now Tim Walz. Even Josh Shapiro, who is in the running to be her vice presidential nominee, gave a rip-roaring speech in Philadelphia a couple of days ago. This seems a little unusual for Democrats, but does it speak to the existential nature of how Democrats view this election?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think if you talk to Democrats, they'll tell you they have a pretty deep bench when you look at presidential candidates. And if anything, this past month really speaks to timing. There are a lot of people who want to be candidates. It's got to be matched up with the timing of whether it's actually there.
I'll give you on the other side. I threw you a curveball. I'm sorry about that. We have to take a break. We're here with Ruben Jones and Danielle Battaglia. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Danielle Battaglia, congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Ruben Jones, who is the Washington reporter on politics and North Carolina for Spectrum News. And I kind of threw you a curve, Ruben, asking you to answer a question in 20 seconds. But the Democrats have circled the wagons around Kamala Harris and around Tim Walz. Even those who were in the running for her vice presidential nominee have said they're the greatest thing since sliced bread. This is very unusual for Democrats to do it so quickly and to become unified so quickly with a unified message. We hear that they believe that this is an existential election, that if Donald Trump wins, this is the end of democracy as we have known it, the end of the government as we have known it. And they keep pointing to Project 2025 as an example of that. What are you hearing behind the scenes? Is that how they really feel, or is it hyperbole for the public?
No, I think that's definitely what they feel. But what's interesting, Mike, is the framing. So under Biden, you heard that discussed a lot, the importance of protecting democracy. Kamala Harris and now Tim Walz are taking a little bit of a different approach, where they're taking on this so-called joyful warrior, where they are spreading a message of positivity and joy, while also trying to separate the differences of what a Trump administration would mean for reproductive rights and everything else. And so there's a different approach here. I'm really interested to see how Walz plays and how the campaign approaches after this week. So we know this week they're going to be together, Harris and Walz, and they're campaigning. I'm interested to see, where does Walz go? Does he go to some of the more rural areas, North Carolina, for example, where he's from? He grew up in a small town, and try and appeal to voters there. And what's his framing of some of the issues you talk about, Mike, with democracy and things like that? I think that's going to be pretty interesting to follow.
Danielle, I'm already hearing pundits on TV talk shows talk about, can Kamala Harris maintain this unification of this party for the next 89 days? That doesn't seem like a long time, but it is a long time in the political cycle, particularly with how quickly it moves now. Are they going to be able to stick to this enthusiasm, this joy, this unified approach for the next 89 days until the election?
I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, but, you know, this message, we saw it even at RNC after the attempted assassination. They were preaching unity, and I felt like that quickly peeled away from the Republican Party. This seems overwhelming with the Democrats. But everyone's saying they're in a honeymoon period right now, and it's yet to be seen how long this will be maintained and whether this will keep up. I will say there is so much enthusiasm right now from Democrats behind both Harris and Walz that I'm not sure when that honeymoon period ends for them and whether that is going to go away in 89 days. But a lot has happened in the last 3 weeks in politics. So it's anyone's guessing game.
And Ruben, we talked a little bit about this earlier in our conversation, the fact that she is packing arenas where she goes now, and the atmosphere is not unlike the kind of enthusiasm that Donald Trump experienced in his arenas 4 years ago. They were to have come here, both sides, Harris and Walz, along with J.D. Vance on the Republican side. But the storm has kept them away, at least temporarily. But you were there at a Georgia rally for Kamala Harris, and it was enthusiastic, to say the least. Do you think she has a shot at taking Georgia, which is an important state for the Democrats to take if they're going to win?
Yeah, I think she does. Under Biden, it would have been a lot more difficult. What we're seeing Harris do is energize more Black voters, more younger voters. And look, Georgia was really Democrats' saving grace in 2022, helping them in the Senate with Raphael Warnock, and then in 2020 with Joe Biden, Raphael Warnock again. And so, yeah, I think Georgia has a pretty good play. A little harder in North Carolina, which I'm sure we'll get to, but I think Democrats feel pretty good, or at least better than they did a few weeks ago about Georgia. Still going to be really tough, but and it was interesting to see, Mike, the same place that Harris did her rally just a week later on the campus of Georgia State University, Trump did this same location for his rally as well.
How well was it attended?
Harris rally, very well attended. From what I wasn't at the Trump rally, but it looked like it was a decently attended crowd.
So one of the reasons that we are told Joe Biden decided not to run is because he realized that his path to victory through the Electoral College had evaporated. There was no path to victory. What we're hearing now is that Kamala Harris has several paths to victory, but they all include going through the key Democratic traditional blue wall states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. And to some degree, I suppose, North Carolina, which is why Roy Cooper was perhaps being considered as a possible VP choice. Do North Carolina politicians, Danielle, believe that we can become bluish purple enough to play a role in any victory for a Kamala Harris campaign?
I believe Democratic politicians in North Carolina believe it's possible. North Carolina, it's basically known as a purple state, even though only President Barack Obama won it since 1976, and that was in 2008. But the margin has been incredibly small. I think it's been less than 4% every time. In 2020, it was 1.3% between President Trump, who won it, and President Biden, who lost it. That was the smallest margin of any other state. And so there is a firm belief that if they put enough attention into North Carolina this cycle, they can flip it blue. And so we've seen so much effort from Democrats in getting surrogates here, I think on an almost weekly basis, if not weekly. and just trying as hard as they can to make the state no longer a Republican leaning state.
And the ground game too, Mike, is the Democrats have invested early. They hired staff early. They put a lot of money, volunteers, and they spread it around the state. You've got a leader, Anderson Clayton, who I think, Danielle, if correct me if I'm wrong, is the youngest Democratic Party leader in the country. And so she's put a lot of attention on not only younger voters, but rural voters. And can you drive some of those voters to the polls that have not been turning out in some of the places? And you know this, Mike, Mecklenburg County has not been really strong when it comes to voter turnout in the recent elections. And so they've got to do better, Democrats in Mecklenburg County and Charlotte, if they're going to win in November.
I think Mecklenburg County's voter turnout is the worst in the state when you analyze it. You say, Ruben, that or they say, maybe you say this too, I don't know, but they say that this election will hinge on unaffiliated voters, on disaffected Republicans perhaps going to the Democratic side, and mostly it will hinge on voter turnout. There were fears on both sides with a Biden-Trump rematch that voters would be so disillusioned and so uninterested that they simply wouldn't vote. They wouldn't come out. Now we have a whole different set of candidates we have two Democrats and one half of the Republican ticket that are different than it might have been. Will this fire up Democrats to the point that we can become a bluish purple state, or will it fire up Republicans who are witnessing the enthusiasm on the Democratic side, and they know they have to come out if they want to take this state? I'll start with you, Ruben.
I think it's too early to know at this point, Mike. I am not a fan of polls. I very rarely use them in my reporting. But I will say the polls are doing better for Harris, and the margins are narrowing. We're even seeing her ahead in some places that we weren't seeing before. So that's good news for Democrats. You look at North Carolina. Do Democrats have a chance of winning? Absolutely. Is it going to be hard? You bet. I tell people that North Carolina is a purple state, but it really needs to prove it because they haven't been able to prove it for a while. They're consistently red, at least on the presidential level. That's why Roy Cooper was a popular idea for VP, because he's one of the few Democrats that's been able to win statewide. So I don't know. Danielle, maybe you have a better idea on whether she'll win Kamala Harris. But I think Democrats are approaching this presidential election differently than they have in the past. They have a fair shot at it, but it's still an uphill battle when you look at the six or seven swing states. North Carolina might be the biggest reach with all of them, but they have a shot.
You want to chime in on that?
I agree with everything Ruben just said. I am really interested. I had done a story on what voters are thinking across the aisles with voting before Biden pulled out of the race. And I'm really interested to go back and talk to those same voters, because they were very turned off by this election. They wanted different candidates. They wanted younger candidates. They've got it now. I want to know how much energy they have now to get to the polls and whether it changed what they were thinking when I talked to them back in June.
We talked a little bit about this when Alma Adams was with us earlier in the program. We have the shakeup coming in this election because of gerrymandering and because of the redistribution of voting districts. And some incumbents have been left out in the cold. As I mentioned, Jeff Jackson, one of them, is running for attorney general against Dan Bishop, another congressman, because Jeff Jackson's district essentially evaporated. He had no chance at victory. So this will end the 7-7 divide that we have in our North Carolina congressional delegation, which is 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans. It'll be out of balance. What impact might that have, Danielle, on voter turnout in North Carolina? Will it energize one party or the other?
I actually don't see that. I don't think it would energize them, because really with our congressional districts, there's one race that really matters for people to go out and vote, and that's the first congressional district up in our far eastern counties. That's the only one that's truly a swing district. Every other one basically has their candidate locked in, and it would be hard to overcome those candidates and get somebody else to win because of how the maps were drawn. So the districts that are going Republican are probably going to be Republican, and the ones going Democrat are going to be Democrat. And the lawmakers did a good job of selecting who we're going to have as our next lawmakers.
If a Kamala Harris campaign were to win, a lot of what she would like to do, a lot of what a President Biden would have liked to do had he run again, would be to pass a lot of legislation that Republicans fundamentally disagree with. So, Ruben, as gerrymandering takes place in North Carolina and our delegation becomes more Republican, what impact might that have on the final makeup of the House? We're not going to play a role in the Senate campaign this time around because neither of our senators are up. But what will this shift in our delegation mean to the makeup of Congress? Would it likely hinder any perhaps Democratic takeover of Congress?
Yeah, it's significant, Mike, because the margins are so narrow right now in Congress in terms of Republican control. I think it's just a couple now. It fluctuates so much in terms of how much Republicans control. So, yeah, the fact that North Carolina is guaranteed, well, almost guaranteed to lose three Democrats, potentially four, that's significant. But the good news for Democrats is they are picking up some seats in New York, not as many as some Democrats would have liked because of the new congressional map there. And there's some other places where they might pick up as well. So I think House is going to be so close in November. You look at all the dysfunction that happened there in the past few years. Right now, we're not getting a lot of attention on the House of Representatives, but there should be because there's been a lot that's happened there just in terms of sort of the level of dysfunction, if you will. In the Senate, and I heard Congresswoman Alma Adams say, we hope that the Democrats will take over the Senate. It's going to be really tough for Democrats to pick up the Senate. I mean, they have a chance, but when you look at some of the seats where Democrats are going up, it's not a good chance of winning West Virginia with Joe Manchin leaving. Montana is going to be a tough fight for John Tester, Ohio for Sherrod Brown, and a few others. So Senate could be really interesting as well, Mike.
And one of the reasons they picked J.D. Vance on the other side of the aisle was to do with his connection to Ohio and working class people, et cetera. And of course, the Hillbilly Elegy book that he wrote, that he has this real populist impression of him, I suppose, going out there. Danielle, criticism of him has already started on the Democratic side. And I'm sure we've already started to hear things about Tim Walz, whether they'll stick to the wall or not remains to be seen. But what are we hearing in this state about these two choices for vice president, J.D. Vance and Tim Walz?
I mean, I think everything I'm hearing from North Carolinians echo what you're hearing nationally. You know, there's the criticism of J.D. Vance attacking women throughout his career. There's the attacks on Walz for various things. I'm trying to think of them off the top of my head right now, and I'm blanking, but there's been attacks on him. Yeah, that kind of thing. So it's very much echoing what you're hearing nationwide.
Well, he's being accused on the right of having gotten retired from the military just as his unit was about to be deployed. And he says that's because he wanted to run for Congress. But that aside, in addition to being his resume was spelled out in clear detail at that Philadelphia rally. In addition to being a family man, he's a school teacher. He's a high school football coach. He was the Minnesota governor. He was a veteran. He's worked in Congress on veterans affairs. He left the service as a sergeant major, which is evidently a significant accomplishment for an enlisted person. How might that play in North Carolina, Danielle, in a state that has a lot of military bases, has a lot of veterans living here? How might that play in a state where so many people, it would seem, would share his family values?
I think people will be watching it very closely, especially if there's criticism on the military. They're going to be watching to see what happens with the criticism and whether it's found to be true. With the family values, I mean, that is something that North Carolinians really put a lot of value into. But that's also in the rural areas, the Republican areas. And I'm curious how that's going to play out with Democrats in those rural areas.
Meaning what? That they might not be as enthusiastic about the family values aspect of him?
That is what I'm saying. North
Carolina
really?
Are you kidding?
Interesting. I mean, I worked in rural North Carolina for a while, and I have seen them, you know, they have their opinions.
Okay. Republicans have already labeled Kamala Harris as an extreme liberal and Waltz as a liberal lapdog. Reuben, are either of those descriptions accurate, or are these two candidates more moderate and pragmatic than they are ultra-liberal?
Well, when you look at Tim Walz's record, when he was in Congress, he represented a very purple district and was known as a moderate Democrat. So that doesn't really apply in this case. You look at his time as governor, he signed a number of bipartisan bills, but he did also have some progressive actions that they could point to.
And with that, we have to stop. I'm very sorry. Reuben Jones from Spectrum News, Danielle Battaglia from The Observer, and the News and Observer in Raleigh. Thank you both for this hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.